They waited, hidden in the wadi, until after nightfall. Then the wheel hubs freshly greased with mutton fat to stop them squealing, the horses' hooves covered with leather boots, and all the loose weapons and tack carefully muffled, they went on, deep into Hyksosian territory, with Gil guiding them. The lance-bearer knew the area well, and although Taita made no comment, he wondered how often the man had travelled this way with his master, and what other rendezvous they'd kept with the enemy. By now they were down on the alluvial plain of the Nile. Twice they had to turn off the road and wait while parties of armed men, anonymous in the darkness, rode past their hiding place. After midnight, they came to an abandoned temple of some forgotten god that had been hollowed out of the side of a low clay hill. The cave was large enough to shelter the entire squadron, vehicles, horses, and men. It was immediately apparent that it had been used before for this purpose. Lamps and an oil amphora were hidden behind the ruined altar, and bales of horse fodder were stacked in the sanctum. As soon as they'd removed the horses' harness and fed them, the troopers ate their own meal and settled down on mattresses of dried straw and were soon snoring. In the meantime, Gil had changed from his cavalry uniform to the nondescript attire of a peasant. "I cannot use a horse," he explained to Taita. "It'll attract too much attention. On foot, it'll take me half a day to reach the camp at Bubasti. Do not expect me back before tomorrow evening." He slipped out of the cave and disappeared into the night. "Honest Gil is not such a simple bluff soldier as he seems," Taita thought, as he settled down to wait for Lord Naja's allies to answer the message that Gil was taking to them. As soon as it was light, he posted a sentry at the top of the hill, where the air shaft from the subterranean temple emerged. Just before noon, a low whistle down the shaft warned them of danger, and Taita climbed up to join the sentry. From the east, a caravan of heavily laden donkeys was heading directly for the temple entrance, and Taita guessed it was these merchants who used the temple as a makeshift caravanserai. It was almost certainly they who had left the store of fodder in the sanctum. He scrambled down the hillside, keeping out of the sight of the approaching caravan. In the middle of the roadway, he arranged a pattern of white quartz stones while he recited three verses from the Assyrian Book of the Evil Mountain. Then he retired to await the arrival of the caravan. The leading donkey was 50 cubits or so ahead of the rest of the column. It was clear that the animal knew of the temple and the delights it contained, for he needed no encouragement from his driver to come on at a trot. As he reached the pile of white quartz stones in the path, the little animal shied so violently that the pack slid over and hung under his belly. He started to buck and gallop at the same time, heading out across the plain away from the temple, hoofs flying in every direction. His horse, honking and braying, affected the rest of the animals in the column, and soon they were rearing and throwing their heads against the lead reins, kicking out at their drivers, and running in circles as though attacked by a swarm of bees. It took the caravan drivers half of the rest of the afternoon to catch and reassemble the runaways, to pacify the terrified animals, and to set off again on the road towards the temple. This time, the portly and richly robed figure of the head driver marched in the van, dragging the reluctant donkey behind him on a long rein. He saw the stones in the middle of the road and stopped. The column crowded up behind him, and the other drivers came forward. They held an impromptu conference with raised voices and arms waving. Their voices carried to where Taita was hidden among the olive trees on the hillside. At last the head driver left the others and came on alone. At first his step was bold and assured, but soon it slowed and became timid, until at last he stood ill at ease, and from a distance studied the pattern of quartz stones. Then he spat upon the stones and jumped back, as if he expected them to return the insult. Finally, he made the sign against the evil eye, turned and trotted back with alacrity to join his fellows, shouting and waving them back. The others needed little convincing. Soon the entire caravan was in full retreat along the road it had come. Taita went down the hill and scattered the stones, allowing the influences they contained to disperse, and opening the way for the other visitors he was expecting. They came in the short summer dusk, 20 armed men riding hard, Gil leading them on a borrowed steed. They swept down past the scattered stones and up to the entrance of the temple, where they dismounted with a clatter of weapons. The leader was a tall man, wide across the shoulders, with a heavy beetling brow and a fleshy hooked nose. His heavy black moustaches were trained to droop down onto his chest, and coloured ribbons were plaited into his beard.
"You're the warlock, eh?"
he said in a thick accent. Taita did not think it opportune to let them know he spoke Hyksos like one of them, so he replied modestly in Egyptian, neither claiming nor denying magical powers. "My name is Taitan, a servant of the great god Horus. I call his blessing down upon you. I see that you are a man of might, but I do not know your name."
"My name is Trok, paramount chief of the clan of the Leopard, and commander of the north in the army of King Apepe. You have a token for me, warlock."
Taita opened his right hand and showed him the broken shard of blue glazed porcelain, the upper half of a tiny votive statue of the god Sueth. Trok examined it briefly, then took another fragment of porcelain from the pouch on his sword belt and fitted the two pieces together. The broken edges matched perfectly, and he grunted with satisfaction.
"Come with me, warlock."
Trok strode out into the gathering night with Taita beside him. They climbed the hill in silence and squatted down facing each other in the starlight. Trok kept his scabbard between his knees and his hand on the hilt of his heavy sickle sword. From habit more than distrust, Taita thought. But nevertheless, the war chief was a man to reckon with.
"You bring me news of the south,"
Trok said in a statement, not a question.
"My lord, you have heard of the death of Pharaoh Tamoza?"
"We know of the death of the Theban pretender from prisoners captured when we took the city of Abnob."
Trok was careful not to acknowledge by word or inference the authority of the Egyptian pharaoh. To the Hyksos, the only ruler in either of the two kingdoms was Apepe.
"We also heard that a child now pretends to the throne of Upper Egypt."
"Pharaoh Nefertiti is only 14 years of age," Taita confirmed, equally careful to insist on the title of pharaoh when he spoke of him. "He will not attain his majority for some years. Until then, Lord Naja acts as his regent."
Trok leant forward with sudden intense interest. Taita smiled inwardly. The Hyksosian intelligence was poor indeed, if they did not know at least that much about the affairs of the Upper Kingdom. Then he recalled the campaign that just before the king's death he and Pharaoh Tamoza had waged against Hyksosian spies and informers in Thebes. They'd winkled out and arrested over 50. After interrogation by torture, they'd executed every one. Taita felt a smug satisfaction at this confirmation that they had cut off the flow of information to the enemy.
"So then you come to us with the authority of the regent of the south?"
Taita detected a strange air of triumph about Trok as he demanded,
"What message do you bring from Naja?"
"Lord Naja wants me to carry this proposal directly to Apepe," Taita hedged. He did not want to give Trok any more information than was strictly necessary.
Trok took immediate umbrage at this.
"Naja is my cousin," he said coldly. "He would wish me to hear every word he has sent."
Taita had such control over his emotions that he showed no surprise, although it was a grave indiscretion on Trok's part. His suspicions as to the regent's antecedents were confirmed. But his voice was measured as he answered,
"Yes, my lord, this much I know. However, what I have for Apepe is of such moment..."
"You underestimate me, warlock. I have the complete confidence of your regent."
Trok's voice was rough with exasperation.
"I know full well that you come to offer Apepe a truce and to negotiate a lasting peace with him.
I can tell you nothing more, my lord. This Trock might be a warrior, but he's no conspirator, Taita thought. But his voice and manner did not change as he said, I can give my message only to the shepherd chieftain, Apepi. This was how the Hyksosian ruler was referred to in Upper Egypt. Can you take me to him?
As you wish, warlock. Keep your mouth shut if you will, though there's no purpose in it.
Trock stood up angrily.
King Pepi is at Bubasti. We'll go there immediately.
In stilted silence they returned to the subterranean temple, where Taita called Gil and the sergeant of the bodyguard to him.
You have done your work well, he told them, but now you must return to Thebes as secretly as you have come.
Will you return with us? Gil asked anxiously. Clearly he felt responsible for the old man.
No, Taita shook his head. I will remain here. When you report to the regent, tell him that I am on my way to meet Apepi.
By the dim light of the oil lamps, the horses were harnessed to the chariots, and within a short time they were ready to leave. Gil brought Taita's leather saddlebag from the chariot and handed it to him. Then he saluted respectfully.
It's been a great honour to ride with you, my lord. When I was a child, my father told me many tales of your adventures. He rode with your regiment at Asyut. He was captain of the left wing.
What was his name? Taita asked.
Lazaro, my lord.
Yes, Taita nodded.
I remember him well.
He lost his left eye in the battle. Gil gazed at him with awe and wonder.
That was 40 years ago. And still you remember?
37, Taita corrected him. Go well, young Gil. I cast your horoscope last night. You'll have a long life and attain much distinction. The lance-bearer took up the reins and rode out into the night, speechless with pride and gratification. By this time Lord Trock's troop was also mounted and ready to leave. They had given Taita the horse on which Gil had returned to the temple. Taita threw the saddlebags over its withers, then swung up behind them. The Hyksos did not have the same scruples about riding astride as the Egyptians, and they clattered out of the cave entrance and turned west, in the opposite direction to that taken by the column of chariots. Taita rode in the centre of the party of heavily armed Hyksos. Trog led them and did not invite Taita to ride alongside him. He had been distant and aloof since Taita had refused to give Naja's message to him directly. Taita was content to be ignored, for he had much to think about. In particular, the revelation of Naja's confused bloodlines opened a host of fascinating possibilities. They rode on through the night, heading west towards the river and the main enemy base at Bubasti. Even though it was still night time, they encountered more and more traffic on the road. There were long lines of wagons and carts, all heavily laden with military supplies, moving in the same direction as they were. Returning towards Avaris and Memphis were equal numbers of empty vehicles that had discharged their cargo. As they came closer to the river, Taita saw the fires of the Hyksosian troops encamped around Bubasti. It was a field of flickering light that stretched many miles in both directions along the riverbank, a huge agglomeration of men and animals, unseen in the darkness. There was nothing on earth like the smell of an army encamped. It grew stronger as they approached until it was almost overpowering. It was a mixture of many odours, the smell of the cavalry lines, manure and the smoke of dung fires, of leather and mouldy grain. On top of this was the smell of unwashed men and their festering wounds, cooking food and fermenting beer, unburied rubbish and filth, the ammoniacal reek of the latrine pits and the dung heaps, and the even more biting stench of unburied corpses. Underlying this stifling blend of odours, Taita picked out another sickly taint. He thought he recognized it, but it was only when one of the sufferers staggered drunkenly in front of his horse, forcing him to rein in sharply, that he saw the rose-colored blotches on the pale face, and he was certain. He knew now why Apepi had failed so far to follow up his victory at Abnob, why he had not yet sent his chariots tearing southwards towards Thebes, where the Egyptian army was in disarray and at his mercy. Taita pulled his horse up alongside Trok's mount and asked him quietly, "My lord, when did the plague first strike your troops?" Trok reined in so roughly that his mount danced and circled under him.
"Who told you that, warlock?" he demanded. "Is this cursed disease one of your spells? Is it you who have laid this pestilence upon us?"
He spurred away angrily without waiting for a denial. Taita followed at a discreet distance, but his eyes were busy taking in every detail of what was happening around him. By this time the light was strengthening, and a weak, hazy sun barely showed through the heavy bank of mist and wood smoke that blanketed the land and blotted out the dawn sky. It gave the scene a weird, unearthly aspect, like a vision of the underworld. Men and animals were transformed by it into dark and demoniacal figures, and under the hooves of their horses the mud of the recent inundation was black and glutinous. They passed the first of the burial carts, and the men around Taita used their cloaks to cover their mouths and noses against the stink and the evil humours that hung over the heap of naked, bloated corpses piled high in the back of the cart. Trok spurred his horse to overtake it quickly, but ahead there were many more similarly laden vehicles almost blocking the roadway. Further on they passed one of the cremation fields, on which more carts were unloading their grisly burden. Firewood was a scarce commodity in this land, and the flames were not fierce enough to consume the heaps of corpses. They spluttered and flickered as the fat oozed out of the decaying flesh, and sent up clouds of oily black smoke that coated the mouths and throats of the living men who breathed it. How many of the dead are victims of the plague, Taita wondered, and how many from the fighting with our army? The plague was like some grim spectre that marched in step with any army. Apepi had been here at Bubasti for many years in camps that swarmed with rats, vultures, and the carrion-eating marabou stalks. His men were crowded together in their own filth, their bodies crawling with fleas and lice, eating rotten food, and drinking the water from the irrigation canals, into which the effluent from the graves and dung heaps drained. These were the conditions in which the plague flourished. Closer to Bubasti, the encampments became more numerous, tents, huts, and hovels crowded right up to the walls and ditches that surrounded the garrison town. The more fortunate among the plague victims lay under tattered roofs of palm fronds, scant protection from the hot morning sunlight. Others lay out in the trampled mud of the fields, abandoned to thirst and the elements. The dead were mixed with the dying, those wounded in the fighting lying side by side with those ravaged by streaming dysentery. Although his instincts were those of a healer, Taita would do nothing to succour them. They were condemned by their own multitudes, for what could one man do to help so many? What was more, they were the enemies of this very Egypt, and it was clear to him that the pestilence was a visitation from the gods. Should he heal a single Hyksos, it would mean that there was one more to march on Thebes and put his beloved city to flame and rapine. They entered the fortress and found that conditions were not much better within its walls. Plague victims lay where they'd been struck down by the disease, and the rats and pariah dogs gnawed at their corpses, and even at those still alive but too far gone to defend themselves. Apepi's headquarters was the principal building in Bubasti, a massive, sprawling mud-brick and thatch palace in the centre of the town. Grooms took their horses at the gates, but one carried Taita's saddlebags. Lord Trok led Taita through courtyards and the dark shuttered halls where incense and sandalwood burned in bronze braziers to cloak the plague stench that wafted up from the town and the surrounding encampments, but whose guttering flames made the heated air scarcely bearable. Even here in the main headquarters, the groans of plague victims rang eerily through the rooms, and huddled figures lay in dark corners. Sentries stopped them outside a barred bronze door in the deepest recesses of the building, but as soon as they recognized Trock's hulking figure, they stood aside and allowed them to pass through. This area was Apepi's private quarters. The walls were hung with magnificent carpets, and the furniture was of precious wood, ivory, and mother-of-pearl, much of it plundered from the palaces and temples of Egypt. Trock ushered Taita into a small but luxuriously furnished antechamber and left him there. Female slaves brought him a jug of sherbet and a platter of ripe dates and pomegranates. Taita sipped the drink, but ate only a little of the fruit. He was always abstemious. It was a long wait. A sunbeam through the single high window moved sedately along the opposite wall, measuring the passage of time. Lying on one of the carpets, he used his saddlebags as a pillow, dozing, never sinking into deep sleep, and coming instantly awake at every noise. At intervals he heard the distant sound of women weeping and the keening wail of mourning somewhere beyond the massive walls. At last there came the tramp of heavy footsteps down the passage outside, and the curtains over the doorway were thrown open. A burly figure stood in the doorway. He wore only a crimson linen kilt, belted below his great belly with a gold chain. His chest was covered with grizzled wiry curls, coarse as the pelt of a bear. There were heavy sandals on his feet, and greaves of hard polished leather covered his shins. But he carried no sword or other weapon. His arms and legs seemed massive as the pillars of a temple, and were covered with battle scars, some white and silky, long ago healed. Others, more recent, were purple and angry-looking. His beard and dense bush of hair were grizzled also, but lacking the usual ribbons or plaits. They had not been oiled or combed and were in careless disarray. His dark eyes were wild and distracted, and his thick lips under the great beaked nose were twisted as if with pain. "You are Taita, the physician," he said. His voice was powerful, but without accent, for he'd been born in Avaris and had adopted much of the Egyptian culture and way of life. Taita knew him well. To him, Apepi was the invader, the bloody barbarian, mortal enemy of his country and his pharaoh. It took all the exercise of his self-control to keep his expression neutral and his voice calm as he replied, "I am Taita."
"I've heard of your skills," said Apepi. "I need them. Now, come with me."
Taita slung the saddlebags over his shoulder and followed him out into the cloister. Lord Trock was waiting there with an escort of armed men. They fell in around Taita as he followed the Hyksosian king deeper into the palace. Ahead the sound of weeping became louder, until Apepi threw aside the heavy curtains that covered another doorway and took Taita's arm to push him through. Dominating the crowded chamber was a large contingent of priests from the temple of Isis in Avaris. Taita's lip curled as he recognized them by their headdress of egret feathers. They were chanting and shaking sistrums over the brazier in one corner, in which cauterizing tongs glowed red hot. Taita's professional feud with these quacks went back two generations. Apart from the healers, 20 others were gathered around the sickbed in the centre of the floor, courtiers and army officers, scribes and other officials, all looking solemn and funereal. Most of the women were kneeling on the floor, wailing and keening. Only one was making any attempt to nurse the young boy who lay on the couch. She seemed not much older than her patient, probably 13 or 14 years of age, and she was sponging him down with heated, perfumed water from a copper bowl. With a single glance, Taita saw that she was a striking-looking girl, with a determined, intelligent face. Her concern for her patient was evident, her expression loving, and her hands, quick and competent. Taita switched his attention to the boy. His naked body was also well-formed, but wasted by disease. His skin was blotched with the characteristic stigmata of the plague, and dewed with perspiration. On his chest were the raw and inflamed wounds where he'd been bled and cauterized by the priests of Isis. Taita saw that he was in the final stages of the disease. His thick dark hair was sodden with sweat. It hung over his eyes, which were sunken into plum-coloured cavities, open and bright with fever, but unseeing.
"This is Kayan, my youngest son,"
Apepi said as he went to the bedside and looked down at the child helplessly.
"The plague will take him, unless you can save him, Magus."
Kayan groaned and rolled onto his side with his knees drawn up in agony to his lacerated chest. With an explosive spluttering sound, a mixture of liquid feces and bright blood spurted from between his shrunken buttocks onto the soiled bed linen. The girl who was nursing him at once cleaned his backside with the cloth, then wiped up the mess on the sheets without any sign of distaste. In the corner, the healers renewed their chants, and the high priest took up a pair of hot tongs from the charcoal brazier and came towards the bed. Taita stepped forward, barring the man's way with his long staff.
"Get out," he said softly. "You and your butchers have done enough damage here."
"I must burn the fever out of his body," the man protested.
"Out," Taita repeated grimly. Then to the others who crowded the chamber, "Out, all of you." "I know you well, Taita. You're a blasphemer and a familiar of demons and evil spirits."
The priest stood his ground and brandished the glowing bronze instrument menacingly.
"I do not fear your magic. You have no authority here. The prince is in my charge."
Taita stepped back and dropped his staff at the feet of the priest, who shrieked and sprang back as the rod of tambuti wood began to writhe, hiss, and snake towards him over the tiles. Suddenly it reared up head high, its forked tongue darting between thin, grinning lips and its beady black eyes glittering. Instantly there was a yelling stampede for the door. Courtiers and priests, soldiers and servants panicked, clawing and elbowing their way through the press to be the first out. In his haste to escape, the high priest knocked over the brazier, then screamed as he danced barefoot on the scattered coals. Within seconds the chamber was deserted, except for Apepi, who had not moved, and the girl at the sickbed. Taita stooped and picked up the writhing serpent by the tail. Instantly it was straight, rigid, and wooden in his grasp. He pointed the restored staff at the girl at the bedside.
"Who are you?" he demanded.
"I'm Mintaka. This is my brother."
She laid her hand protectively on the boy's sweat-damp curls and lifted her chin with a defiant air.
"Do your worst, Magus, but I will not leave him."
Her lips trembled and her dark eyes were huge with terror. She was clearly overawed by his reputation and by the serpent staff that Taita was pointing at her.
"I'm not afraid of you," she told him,
then moved around the bed until it was between them.
"Good," said Taita briskly. "Then you will be of more use to me. When did the boy last drink?"
It took a moment for her to gather herself.
"Not since this morning."
"Can't those quacks see that he's dying of thirst as much as from disease? He sweated and voided most of the water from his body."
Taita grunted and picked up the copper jug from beside the bed to sniff the contents.
"This is foul with priest poison and plague humours." He hurled it at the wall. "Go to the kitchens and find another jug. Make sure it is clean. Fill it from the well, not with river water. Hurry, girl."
She fled, and Taita opened his bag.
Mintaka returned almost immediately with a brimming jug of clean water.
Taita prepared a potion of herbs and heated it on the brazier.
"Help me give it to him,"
he ordered the girl when it was brewed. He showed her how to position her brother's head and to stroke his throat as he dribbled the water into his mouth. Soon, Kayan was swallowing freely.
"What can I do to help you?"
the king asked.
"My lord, there is nothing for you here. You are better at destroying than at healing." Taita dismissed him without looking up from his patient. There was a long silence, then the tramp of a Pepe's bronze-studded sandals as he left the chamber. Mintaka soon lost her terror of the Magus, and as a helper she was quick and willing. She seemed able to anticipate Taita's wishes. She forced her brother to drink, while Taita brewed up another cup of medicine from his bag on the brazier. Between them, they were able to get this down his throat without losing a drop. She helped him smear a soothing ointment on the burns that covered his chest. Then, between them, they wrapped Kayan in linen sheets and soaked them with well water to cool his burning body. When she came to sit beside him to rest for a moment, Taita took her hand and turned it palm upwards. He examined the red lumps on the middle of her wrist, but Mintaka tried to pull her hand away. "Those are not plague spots," she flushed with embarrassment. "They're only flea bites. Palaces crawling with fleas." "Where the flea bites, the plague follows," Taita told her. "Take off your shift." She stood up without hesitation and let it drop around her ankles. Her naked body, though slim and nubile, was also athletic and strong. Her breasts were in first bud, the perky nipples pricking out like ripening mulberries. A triangle of soft fluff nestled between her long, shapely legs. A flea hopped from her pale belly. Deftly, Taita picked it out of the air and crunched it between his fingernails. The insect had left a chain of pink spots around her neatly puckered belly button. "Turn round," he ordered, and she obeyed. Another of the loathsome insects ran down her back towards the deep cleft between her hard, round buttocks. Taita pinched it between his fingers and crushed its shiny black carapace. It popped in a spot of blood. "You'll be the next patient if we don't get rid of these little pets of yours," he told her, and sent her to fetch a bowl of water from the kitchens. On the brazier, he boiled up the dried purple flowers of the pyrethrum plant and washed her down from head to toe in the brew. He snapped four or five more fleas that tried to escape the pungent douche by leaping off her drenched skin. Afterwards, Mintaka sat beside him while her naked body dried and chatted unself-consciously as they picked over her clothes companionably, removing the last fleas and their eggs from the seams and pleats. They were fast becoming good friends. Before nightfall, Kayan's bowels voided once more, but sparingly, and there was no blood in the stool. Taita sniffed the feces, and the stench of the plague humours was milder. He administered a stronger distillation of the herbs, and between them they forced Kayan to drink another jugful of well water. By next morning, the fever had broken, and Kayan was resting more comfortably. He urinated at last, which Taita declared to be beneficial, even though his water was dark yellow and acrid. An hour later he passed more water, lighter in colour, and not so evil-smelling.
"Look, my lord," Mintaka exclaimed, stroking her brother's cheek. "The red blotches are fading and his skin feels cooler."
"You have the healing touch of a nymph of paradise," Taita told her. "But do not forget the water jug. It's empty."
She raced away to the kitchens and came back almost immediately with a brimming jug. While she gave it to him, she began to sing a Hyksosian lullaby, and Taita was delighted by the sweetness and clarity of her voice. "Listen to the wind in the grass, little darling. Sleep, sleep, sleep. Hear the sound of the river, my little baby. Dream, dream, dream." Taita studied her face. In the Hyksosian way, it was a little too broad, and the cheekbones too prominent. Her mouth was large, her lips full, her nose strongly bridged. None of these features was perfect in itself, but each was finely balanced with and matched to all the others, and her neck was long and graceful,
Her almond-shaped eyes were truly magnificent under arched black brows. Her expression was alert and bright. Hers was a different kind of beauty, he thought, but beauty nonetheless. Look! She broke off the song and laughed. He's awake!
Diane's eyes were open, and he was looking up at her.
You've come back to us, you horrid little beast! And she laughed. Her teeth were square and very white in the lamplight. We were so worried. You must not do that again, ever.
She hugged him to hide the tears of joy and relief that suddenly sparkled in her eyes. Taita looked beyond the pair on the bed and saw the bulky figure of Apepi in the doorway. Taita did not know how long he had been there. But now he nodded at Taita without smiling, then turned and disappeared. By that evening, Kayan was able to sit up with a little help from his sister and to drink from the soup bowl she held to his lips. 2 days later, his rash had disappeared. 3 or 4 times a day, Apepi visited the chamber. Kayan was still too weak to rise, but as soon as his father appeared, he touched his heart and his lips in a gesture of respect. On the 5th day, he tottered from the couch and tried to prostrate himself before the king, but Apepi stopped him and lifted him back onto the pillows. Even though his feelings for the boy were clear, Apepi had little to say and left again almost immediately. But in the doorway he looked back at Taita and ordered him to follow with a curt inclination of his head.